Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Welcome back. This is Maciej Halasz here, and I'm
Sally.
Here with Gene.
Yeah.
We're going to continue today our last episode's topic of what does it take to port Linux kernel to a custom or slightly changed platform.
Yeah.
What are the different steps that you have to consider or pay attention to when you do that move?
Yeah. And well, for continuity's sake, right? You know, last time we talked about getting your environment set up, where you get things, and we said we won't spend any time there. I know we got off the track, and we see several emails along the lines of don't ever get off track like that again. And so we're going to try to stay a little bit better on track this time. And we actually have a decent amount of material to cover for our time allotment. So let's might as well, you know, dig in now.
Yeah, well, I didn't think that we made too many digressions last time, but that's okay. One point I wanted to make before we dive into the topic is that, I don't think that we'll be able to cover everything today. We'll focus on primarily different steps or parts of the Linux kernel that you have to pay attention to.
Sure.
But we're not going to explore in detail writing a new device driver or how you construct or forward port a device driver.
Yeah, I just don't. I agree. There's probably no way we could actually talk about that in time.
I think this is a potentially a very interesting topic to our audience. So shoot us an email if that's the case. Mm-hmm. I personally think it is an interesting topic. So perhaps the next subject that we'll cover is exactly that.
Yeah. So today I think we're going to stick mostly on the ARM platform. We're going to talk about doing some kernel porting work. And when we talk about it, we're going to be talking with respect to ARM because, you know, this kind of work is very machine dependent, processor architecture dependent, and what particular processor you're using means you'll be doing, you know, slightly different or greatly different things. And so one of our discussion points, believe it or not, we planned for these. So we were planning out our podcast. We were trying to figure out what processor we would talk, what architecture. So we're going to stick with ARM. So if you're a big PowerPC guy, and you start diving in and looking around for things that we talked about and you don't see them, that's probably more of an artifact of the architecture rather than us, you know, messing things up. But I wouldn't count us messing things up out, but I just, it is very architecture dependent. So I know one of the things we want to talk about a little bit, and not a whole bunch of time, but we did want to talk a little bit about kernel booting just in general. Because when you talk about porting a kernel, what you're really talking about doing is configuration work in the startup code that runs before the kernel proper starts.
Yeah, I agree. So let's spend a few minutes and let's refresh what are the different phases of during the kernel boot up that kernel goes through. And
sure.
Then we can perhaps dive into how that translates into what you have to change and which parts you can kind of like leave unchanged.
Yeah. And I guess the other note is that, you know, a lot of times when folks talk about porting Linux or changing Linux, sometimes this operation isn't necessary at all, right? I mean, if it's kernel configuration you're doing, that's a little bit of a different topic than we're going to talk about if you're, you know, getting some sort of new ARM processor or some, I guess because we're talking about ARM, right? So if you need some sort of new ARM processor that is, you know, a different, as say from a licensee that did some changes to the processor core itself. That's the kind of work we're talking about this time around. That's why it matters so much.
Right.
Because one of the things we want to make sure is we weren't scaring folks off that, you know, if you have a Atmel processor or an XCL processor and you want to change one or two things with respect to how the processor is configured, you don't have to necessarily do this, right?
Right.
This is more along the lines of, hey, I have a licensee here that has a new processor that has done things in a different way, and I need to get Linux running up on that target. I just want to differentiate because those two things are confabulated. And I just want to.
I think that during the last episode we talked about the fact that if you introduce a completely new processor to a Linux kernel, the amount of work that you have to well, go through to add support for entirely new architecture, entirely new, well, maybe not architecture, but processor in that architecture is way too much complex for this podcast to cover that. But we, as you said, definitely are going to focus on what does it take to adopt a specific processor for your new project, where you take most of the design from the reference platform. So if you base your final product on a reference board from a semi vendor, that's exactly the approach that we're going to take.
Today. And that's what 5/9 of the audience will be doing, right? So it's not as though you'll be out there doing a full port for.
So that was a bit of the digression, but let's go back to what you've mentioned just a minute ago. What is it that kernel executes in steps as it boots up?
Yeah, so let's talk about this for a second. So things start with first your bootloader runs. What's printed? So in this particular implementation, some implementations it's slightly different, but we'll stick with this theoretical implementation.
Right, but bootloader is not attached to the Linux kernel. Correct. It's pre-Linux kernel.
That's a good point, yeah. So what happens is that the processor starts up, and usually hard-coded into the processor, right, is some instructions that say, go to this address in memory and begin running, right? And that pulls in, you know, that and that address in memory that it runs is the bootloader. And that bit of bootloader code can be very sophisticated, and that's just if you use something like Red Boot or, I guess, for different architectures, U-Boot, right? So there's different systems, but the bootloader's responsibility is to do enough initialization so that it can load the kernel into memory and set the instruction pointer to the beginning of kernel and then, in essence, go away. Bootloaders themselves are their own little mini operating systems because they manage some devices, they manage a little bit of memory for you. So you can think of it as a tiny operating system if it's a sophisticated bootloader.
Well, you want to have some of the devices initialized when you start working with the board, right? So you want to have a serial console so you can really control the target. And you also want to have some sort of a connection that would allow you to get a Linux kernel across, either a serial connection or Ethernet connection, to then load it to memory and then jumpstart the.
So the bootloader, you know, winds up. It says, "Okay, my job somewhere stored in a stored on the flash, right? Or compiled directly into the bootloader, depending on your bootloader setup. It says, "Okay, I know I'm supposed to go to here, interact with this device, put the kernel at this space in memory, start filling upward, and you know, start the kernel, begin filling upward, set my instruction pointer to this address, and say go." And at that point, you're beginning to execute Linux sometimes, right? A lot of boards are set up, or a lot of Linux implementations are set up such that the kernel is compressed. So the first thing that runs is actually a little decompression program. And compiled into the decompression program is where it should put the kernel once it's decompressed. So the decompression program, typically gzip, right, takes some chunk of memory, it gets a beginning and ending address, runs through that chunk of memory, and expands the kernel. Whenever you see that, you know, kernel is booting or decompressing kernel, that's what's happening. And at that point, it then looks for, or it then begins running code, or pardon me, it resets the instruction pointer, right, and then begins running code. And that's typically the code that's inside of the architecture-specific kernel startup. And that's where we'll sort of pick the story up. Depending upon your platform, I know normally the file for the architecture I work with, the file is, you know, head.s, right? And that's the, you know, first bits of code. And you'll actually notice when the kernel links, right, it'll set things up so that links in first. And that code begins running. And from then on, it's, you know, how it was compiled, and what symlinks were set up during the kernel compilation, what files were copied in the right place as to what runs. We'll talk about, and that's where we're going to spend time digging in there, right? And then, you know, after that finishes running, kernel jumps into kernel start. Matter of fact, there's actually a bit of code in there that says, and all these architecture specific things that says, hey, go to kernel start because you know, I'm now finished my setup phase. And then the higher level starts running. So, and you know, you see things appear on your monitor or whatever. So let's dig in.
What is high level?
Good point. So a high level at this point means I'm going to start configuring my devices. I'm going to set up a serial device. I'm going to, map all my interrupts, my interrupt handler.
Yeah. And okay.
I'm going to get my, console up and running. Start my memory manager, start up all my kernel threads that do who knows what else.
So that's where you'll start seeing messages on your console.
Yeah.
For the kernel boot.
Yeah. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about what happens in that section before you hit kernel start. By the time kernel start happens, most of the architecture specific initialization should be completed.
Yeah.
Does it sound like a safe?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We kind of touched upon that already, but when you look at the Linux kernel source tree, you'll see it organized in a certain way.
Yeah.
For the purpose of our today's podcast, I want to mention actually a subdirectory that's called architecture, ARCH, ARC. And under that subdirectory, you'll find different architecture-specific folders.
Mm-hmm.
Each folder holds architecture-specific code, but it also holds processor-specific code.
Yeah, sort of mishmashed in there.
Yeah, so when you kind of like look at where to start, looking for your board-specific code, that's most likely what you would want to go and just browse through that directory to just familiarize yourself with what are the files that you have at hand that you mm-hmm. can modify, because the point of this exercise is that you don't want to start with a fresh file, typing in what includes and everything. What you want to do is you want to leverage development that's been done in the open source community and perhaps by other developers for the reference board. You want to take that architecture specific code and reuse it in as much portion as you can.
Yeah.
So if you know that, for example, you have, I'm going to use again, an Atmel or an IXP processor as an example.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that your final solution is going to utilize that processor, and your board itself also includes some of the onboard peripherals that you would find on a reference board.
Mm-hmm.
What you would normally do is you would go into architecture-specific subdirectories.
Oh, yeah.
And there you would find a set of subdirectories under ARM. You would find a set of subdirectories that start with Mac, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Mac hyphen, and then actual name of a processor or system that you are working with. So, for mm-hmm. example, IXP 4XX.
Yeah.
When you open that subdirectory, you would find a lot of files that are responsible for some of the initialization steps.
Yes.
So that's more or less the structure of directories that you would browse through. Another important area in the kernel source tree is the include subdirectories, right? So it starts at the top level, goes includes ASM hyphen specific architecture, and there okay. you would find a lot of definitions and header files that are yeah. specific to the platform that you work with. So let's talk about step by step process that we're looking at here.
Sure.
Right. So the first step would be to register the machine that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
Then you potentially might want to, talk to the bootloader, because at that time, the bootloader does not have a control over a processor, but you might still be able to take advantage of some of the values that have been preset by bootloader.
Yeah, there's a bit of a free for all there, because the kernel started up, the memory that the bootloader occupied. If you think of you have to close your eyes and picture the heap, right? So you're consuming memory upward on the heap, unless you do something really bad, like set your kernel on pack address to something really low. But at that point, you'll be able to get an address that points backward to some amount of memory, because memory management hasn't started yet. So yeah. everything is still this big flat address space.
Yeah.
And so the physical, so the address you get is actually a physical address.
Right.
At that point, so the bootloader will, you know, leave some cookie crumbs for you and leave a couple. It'll either leave registers initialized with certain addresses, so you can then go backward and look to see where the memory is kept, or by convention, it's stored in a different spot, and that's where you sort of swipe those kernel parameters.
Yeah.
I remember I went through a. I went through a little bit of an odyssey because I did not understand exactly how the kernel parameters got from the bootloader to the right. And so it's either an address stored in a register, depending on implementation, or some fixed address, which is, you know, not touchy. Everyone agrees not to mess with this area, and it's a null terminated string. It's just copied right out of there.
So you actually already dove into that particular
point. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. And then go ahead.
Well, geez, now I feel bad about going ahead.
Yeah, like you do. I can't believe you.
Yeah. And then, you know, we can get into, then we'll talk about early kernel initialization and, you know, device mapping and setting up your IRQs and that good stuff.
Well, I think that the device mapping is going to be important for this podcast because that's the area where you most likely would have to touch if you have a different subset of devices on your card or if they are connected or mapped to on a board differently.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some interesting stuff there. I know you do probably do a better job of talking about that.
We'll see.
I somehow managed to produce crashes whenever.
We'll finish that podcast talking about device drivers and major subsystems initialization.
Yeah, but for the most part, I mean your device drivers start. I mean you're way past. You've succeeded by that point. So if you got that far, you're doing okay.
Well, but it's a point at which you would start modifying kernels if you add new device drivers or if you want to modify device drivers for performance or adopt third-party device drivers.
Yeah. It's like by that point your boss understands what you're doing, right? So
let's talk about machine registration.
Yeah.
Why is it important and what does it mean?
Well, okay.
So each machine has a unique numerical identifier that allows the kernel to configure certain pieces of a kernel code for that processor or machine. Right? Mm-hmm. It's typically stored in one file that in case of ARM architecture, it sits under ARC ARM tools, and I believe MAC types is the name of the file.
Yeah, MACH-types.
Yeah. If you open it up, you will see that it's a pretty lengthy file, but it has a lot of different machine IDs there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a canonical location for that. I think there's a website or whatever if you want to duke it out over your machine ID. Mm-hmm.
So in most cases, if you leverage work done for a reference platform, you won't have to play too much with machine IDs. You can simply leave the machine ID that's there. In most cases, you're going to just change the memory map or add new device drivers. But if your board is entirely different from a reference platform, if you put all the different peripherals around the processor that are not present on the reference board or in any Linux implementation, then you might consider adding a new machine ID.
Yeah, and as a board vendor, I mean, you may make enough changes to the kernel because what's happened is later on that's used by the kernel to say, hey, you know, what board is this? Am I this board? Can I run on this board? If you're a board vendor, you may have done enough changes to the kernel where you want to stop it from running if it's not running on a certain, because even though the board and architecture everything matches, you just, you know, bad things can happen. You'd rather not have it crash. You'd just rather have it stop in a controlled manner.
Well, and at this point, actually, what comes into play is also the connection to the bootloader.
Oh, yeah.
Because bootloader can stick the value for the machine ID in certain register.
Yeah.
So when you start booting Linux kernel, Linux kernel can check for that value.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the value of that register, it would execute a different initialization code for a different machine. So one way of adopting that mechanism in a Linux kernel is actually to allow one binary Linux kernel to run on multiple boards.
Yeah.
And the way it would work is depending on machine ID that's passed on by bootloader to the kernel, that same binary would execute different initialization code. So it's a very handy mechanism.
Yeah.
If you plan on supporting multiple designs with the same binary kernel image.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I looked at it more on make sure it doesn't crash really bad. But
yeah.
No, it's, yeah.
And I think that you've already covered the purpose of a bootloader in a system, and mm-hmm. How the magic happens between the bootloader and the Linux kernel.
Yeah, I didn't really mean to. I really didn't mean to. But I guess
That's good.
No, but what is that? I guess just covering it. So ARM, I think, is there's a certain register. I mean, it depends on the device, and I think it's in. If you look in the documentation directory, mm-hmm. the documentation directory will tell you, what registers you need to put the pointers in.
Right.
And I think for ARM, it's like R1 is the machine ID, and then in the next register, there's a pointer to the structure that says, hey, this is where all of the different bits of data reside. And that's architecture specific too.
Yes.
It's architecture specific as to what that data structure looks like. But you basically fetch the address, right? And cast a pointer, mm-hmm. and voila, you have your data.
Yeah. So assuming that you don't have to touch that part of the Linux kernel, mm-hmm. Let's move to the next area that we can discuss a bit more, which is a more detailed look at directory structure that is specific to each architecture.
Okay.
So.
And we're going to pick on ARM. I mean, yeah, not pick on ARM, but.
Good point.
We'll stick with ARM because I know it's different for x86 and PowerPC, and who knows what's happening over there on Spark or something like that. Because I've looked at MIPS, whatever else, but once you start getting on the different non-embedded operating systems, I would be completely lost.
Well, so. Those subdirectories are, MM, which is memory management mm-hmm. Dependent code, mm-hmm. right? Where you would find a lot of code that's responsible for initializing the cache, handling direct memory access, initialization
sure.
of that. What else is there?
I think if you generate a page fault, that's what the code is.
Yeah?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
And TLB initializations as well, right? For a specific architecture.
Yeah. Yeah. What's TLB stand for?
I think you told me right before.
Did I? I can't.
Wait a second. Go ahead.
No, it's translation look aside buffer, right?
That's it.
So that's whenever it does memory management. It's like a little cache it holds on to. So you can do that more efficiently.
Yeah, for acceleration of memory management. It's,
5 minutes ago, you should remember.
Well.
To remember that.
When you work with the Linux kernel code, well, I apologize.
Yeah.
But when you work with the Linux kernel code, you never remember all those long, exact definitions. That's why the acronym is there. Okay, so kernel. Kernel subdirectory holds the primary initialization code for the kernel setup.
Mm-hmm.
Different, system call handlers, definitions,
yep.
and different APIs.
Yep.
And I believe that under that kernel, you will have a lot of assembly code, like the head.s, where the actual entry to the kernel-specific initialization really happens.
Yep, that's where it is. And I think, that's where you'll find all that, pre-kernel stuff. And I think whenever you do a syscall, like the code that actually manages the syscall,
mm-hmm.
so that it goes to the right spot. And, so the number, syscall number comes in and it goes to some, that's all handled in there. In general, that's not touched, right? And if you're doing, stays the same, right?
I mean, you can. That untouched, yeah.
Yeah, there's not a lot of changes you have to do in there.
Right.
I can't imagine what you would change, in fact. So.
Well, but if you do actually a bit of development at your device driver level, let's say, there are some other subdirectories where you might find some of the code handy. One of those subdirectories is lib subdirectory.
Yes.
And we were talking right before the podcast about the types of functions that you would find there.
That's where all the gooders are, right? That's where you have what, string handling, and string handling's cousin, right? Memory, you know, the basically mem move, mem copy,
I/O operations.
Yeah, I think it's where the
low level.
Yeah, that's where interrupts are dispatched out of that.
That's right.
So this is where the meat of a lot of your changes are probably be coming in. You have to, you know, fiddle around with the helper functions here if you have specific interrupt handling, or pardon me, dispatching. At this point, it's dispatching because of nothing. And or if you have something very particular you're doing with respect to DMA, which direct memory access, it goes in here.
Absolutely. So then there's a whole bunch of folders that start with Mac, dash specific machine type or machine definition.
Right.
It might be PXA, it might be Atmel's, it might be IXP's. But that's the place where machine type specific code would reside. That's, I would imagine that in many cases, this is the subfolder where you would modify at least one file.
Oh yeah. So I mean, if you need to set up, you know, certain memory mapping so you can get in touch with your Ethernet PHY, you know, if you, you know, so you can make that PHY P, you know, run for you, that's what's going to happen. And I think we were looking at this too. Because I hate to leave the 2.4 crowd out, right? But I know in 2.4, because there are a lot of folks that still do, I don't know, there's a lot of folks that still do work on 2.4, right? And you know,
good point.
And prefer that. But I think that was called Arch Dash machine, right?
Yeah.
So it's slightly different between 2.4 and 2.6.
There was this change, yeah.
And I was never sure about, because we even dug around, and I'm never sure why they changed that, right? it just seemed like it'd be a semantic thing. Yeah, it just seemed to be a semantic thing.
Well, I think that if you have a lot of arc at the end of a day, I mean, you can be confused as to where you are in a kernel structure. So
maybe
that might be one of the reasons.
Yeah. No intention to criticize. Not a criticism. It's just I was just, because I, you know, when I had done this, a lot of this, I was on 2.4, right? So two, like, what? It's different.
So let's talk about the early initialization code, because this is where when the Linux kernel has to set up certain things in order for you to be able to monitor the Linux kernel execution. So for sure, if you want to track the boot up process, you want to have the serial console ready. And at that time, you don't have a virtual memory set up yet. So whatever allocations happen on the physical memory.
Yes.
But there are a couple of, codes that, or lines of code that are being executed there that might be hardware specific. If you're changing the serial port on your particular card, you should take a look at that early initialization code for early serial console initialization.
Yes.
I think that it sits primarily in, well, there's some of that initialization code sitting in an include subdirectory.
Yes.
Under ASM, ARM, and then architecture machine specific subdirectory.
Yeah, and it's really primitive. I mean, the code that's out there is, it's there's basically a clear to send, right? You know, first there's clear to send, and then a character at a time write. And there's a wrapper that goes around that, right? That does what is it called? Put string, right? Something like that. Put str.
Put string.
Yeah. So what put string does? It really defers and says, okay, do I have clear to send? Yeah. Drop a character. Clear to send. Drop a character. Clear to send. Drop a character. And it just follows that loop. Most of anything else you have to make sure you have the right configuration for that device, and make sure that's up and running.
Yeah.
And there's no the other thing too is, unlike the other, there's no ring buffer at this point or anything. It serializes on the prints.
I'm not sure if there's any other device that you would have to initialize at that stage, unless you want to track output from booting over Ethernet, then definitely you would need to initialize the PHY correctly. It's more complex. So in most of the designs that I've seen, people were simply getting serial to do that job.
Yeah, and I think, is that maybe I think I'm off in the woods, but is that the same? Is that the same thing that's used to get KGDB running? I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so.
Yeah,
is it?
It's a different,
because KGDB is kernel. That's running by kernel start, and so you actually have the TTY at that point, right? You have that's the right. device. So that's, okay, never mind. I'm sorry.
We were talking a bit about machine detection, right? And in a code. After the initialization of a serial, what happens is the Linux kernel checks for processor ID, right? And if it finds the processor ID, it calls the function associated with that processor. And that function is, in most cases, I believe, placed under ARC, ARM, memory management unit, and then maybe I'm wrong. I'm just thinking right now. we should have prepared better for
a little terminal here.
Because there's quite a lot of files right now.
But it should fall in the proc info, right? I mean, if you do a find, right? I forgot. So it lives in proc info H. That I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
I think that's underneath the ArchArm, right? It goes ArchArm include something, right?
And I did mention earlier actually where that machine or CPU ID sits. It's in MAC types under specific architecture ARM types, I believe, subdirectory. But anyways, if the machine is identified and a machine specific setup code is being called, and again, if you don't if you're using a processor exactly the way it comes on a reference platform, and a lot of onboard peripherals are also present on your custom design, you probably won't have to touch too much of the processor/architecture specific initialization code.
Okay.
What's the next step? We talked about processor and architecture specific initialization, machine detection. There's actually a nice structure that sits in that ARC ARM tool MAC types. That's where the definitions sit alone. But I'm getting actually confused with PowerPC right now.
Oh yeah.
But anyways, there's the machine start structure that defines information like who is the maintainer of that specific machine or Linux kernel code for that machine. It defines pointers to mappings and interrupt map. It also defines boot vector and the name of the routine that is responsible for machine initialization.
Yeah, because the important thing to get your head around, and I always have trouble getting your head around this, right? So all these routines, they live in some assembler file, right? Mm-hmm. And they're given an address, right? They have a label, because you know how somebody just, hey, gives us a label, whatever. Yeah. And then the kernel will roll through there and say, okay, I'm initializing this machine. And then it pulls out that structure, and then it goes through each of the structures, and it goes through that structure, and that's how it figures out what address basically to point, you know, how to do the call. Because it's one of the things that perpetually confuse me for the system is like, okay, so I have all these assembler functions. They all have all these different entry points. I have as much independence as to what I can call these entry points as I want. But until you go in and populate that that machine, they call it the machine descriptor.
Yeah.
That's how it knows what to call inside of those assembler routines. Right. Because if you look through, you can link in a couple different machines at a time if you want, and it won't collide. You can make mistakes like that, but it's that machine descriptor file that says, okay, because the number of functions you perform are uniform, right? You're always going to set up your memory map. You're always going to set up your IQ initialization. You're always going to set up how that structure is what the kernel uses in order to get the addresses of the things to call.
Well, so that's definitely something that you would have to implement for your custom platform, because most likely you will have a different memory mapping, perhaps a different interrupt scheme.
Sure.
If that's the case, you definitely would want to provide your own implementation of the initialization code for your platform. So. Yeah.
And that's where you can even do things like, so you're talking about, and you brought up earlier, it's like the first thing you do is copy. It sounds weird, but the first thing you do is you copy what someone else did.
Right? Yes.
Not necessarily make a physical copy, but use what's there. And what's neat about this file is that you can say, okay, if my IO mapping is the same as the stock, X scale board, you can just call that function and let it do all its work. You don't have to make a copy of it or anything. But then if you're doing something very, very, very particular with, how the boot parameters are handled, or, the machine initialization function, then that's where you can go to make that change.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, VTable implementation. So I'm an O guy. It's just like, oh man, they did a VTable, right? And so you have more control over what happens.
So another aspect that we actually talked about briefly here, because one of the functions that you would call in that machine start code is how you map your devices.
Sure.
But then also how you map your interrupts.
Uh-huh.
Interrupts are usually stored, the definitions and the numbers are stored inside include file under architecture specific RQS header file.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to a user how those interrupts are ordered.
Or you mean, well, programmer, right?
You
use the kernel, they're out of it.
How the numbering is done.
Yeah, got it.
So if you are attaching a new device or changed how devices are connected to the processor, you might want to reshuffle that interrupt map. So that, if interrupt one is connected on, this is actually theoretical, because I don't think that interrupt one would.
That's what,
If one of your interrupts is connected to, a keyboard or some sort of input device, and it's a different interrupt that's servicing that input on the reference board, might want to change slightly the numbering just to make some similarities with the reference board, so it's not confusing to you when you review the code in a few months.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But then I guess we talked also about memory map. Physical memory map. Where you define where different, for example, where your PCI space is, how different devices talk to the processor. This information usually, is available to you because that's part of the hardware design.
Mm-hmm.
When you design your hardware, when you do connections between different peripherals on a card, that's where you make those decisions as to... what are the buses that interconnect the different peripherals?
Yeah.
And then based on that, and based on the amount of memory that you have available, you can redefine the memory map. Again, that's something that I would suggest you you take from an already existing memory map definition.
Yeah.
And look at what devices are present on a reference board, and how that matches. To the memory map and an operating system in Linux,
yeah,
and then try to make appropriate adjustment relative to your custom hardware.
Yeah. And you do that. I think the you have to fish around. Well, you shouldn't fish around, but it's vmalloc.h, right? That's I always do. You know, file, you know, find.vmalloc.h under Arch, and I believe it's under ASM ARM.
Yeah, there's actually an architecture specific file that holds all those definitions. You can very quickly actually find it by just looking for physical memory allocations.
Yeah. So we're getting the, you know, you're way over time signal.
So before we actually finish.
I don't know, he looks pretty angry. I think he wants us to stop now.
Well, we will make him a bit angrier. And
He's holding up, I think he's meaning 1 minute, but it's not his index finger.
So if I'm not on the next podcast, he got me. But I want to mention one last topic, which will carry us on to the next topic for the next podcast potentially, which is board level device initialization. And that's where new device drivers or third party device drivers come into play. What happens when your custom platform does not have any Linux support?
Sure.
I mean, certain devices don't have Linux support, and how you can manage that. So yeah, I'm not sure if this is going to be our next podcast's topic, but it's a candidate.
So again, if you have any comments, questions, hate mail, whatever, let us know. Podcast at timesys.com. And we try to do our best to answer messages when you get them. We get it's a surprising amount of people write, so feel free to write in and, you know, let us know what you think and what you'd like us to cover. Be more than happy to take your advice over what you want us to talk about.
Yep. And thank you very much for your time today. And talk to you.
Yeah, probably in like 2 weeks, right before Christmas. We'll have one more podcast, and then maybe we'll take a week off.
Maybe.
No. I don't think they'll let us. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.